Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Hi, everybody. We're so glad you came out to the Tattered Cover tonight to support the program for authors and to welcome, most especially, Sam Halpern with his book, A Piece of Canaan, which is his debut novel. Sam grew up in a sharecropping family in northern Kentucky, got his degree from the University of Kentucky in Lexington, and then went on to get his medical degree at the University of Louisville, and then ended up being a nuclear doctor, which is just so impressive. And then even after that, he became infamous, thanks to his son, Justin, who wrote Shit My Dad Says, which, and he became a superstar on Twitter at that time, too. So now he's going to share with us this wonderful novel and talk about his journey to getting it ready for us. So let's welcome him.
Thank you very much, Pat. The name of the book's A Far Piece to Canaan, as in Canaan Land, the biblical Canaan Land. And it's a story of a famous, or he's not famous, but he's a celebrated professor of English literature. He's a very decent man, hardworking. He's won awards. His students love him. He has one problem. He tells the unvarnished truth to everybody who asks him a question, even if they don't ask him a question. As a consequence of this, his colleagues hate him, as you might imagine, and he goes through his career with problems. Now, he's got one real friend, and that's his wife, Nora. He loves Nora beyond anything else. And she's always trying to get him to go back to the sharecropping farm in Kentucky, where he spent many years of his youth, because she knows some things happened back there. She doesn't know everything, but she knows some, because she wants him to exorcise his demons. Well, Samuel doesn't think he's got any demons. Oh, I forgot to tell you, his name is Samuel Zelinsky. But Samuel doesn't believe he's got any demons, and so he always refuses to go. Then, after his career is over and everything is going along hunky-dory, Nora gets a fatal disease. And on her deathbed, she asks him to go back, to promise to go back to the sharecropping farm and revisit it, so that perhaps he can live the rest of his life in peace. So anyway, after being out of Kentucky for 60 years, he goes back and he starts wandering the farm. Everything is dilapidated, but as he wanders the farm, he sees things, he recognizes things from his era back there. And he's amazed at it. Then suddenly, out of nowhere, the kid, you enter the old man's mind, and the kid comes forth, and he tells the story. Samuel Zelinsky, as a boy, is very bright, and he's a kid you'd really like. And he's got a best friend. They're the main sharecroppers, the Zelinskys are. And there's a hired hand by the name of Alfred. Alfred's got a son by the name of Fred. And Fred is just as adventurous and mischievous as you can imagine. He's a regular Huck Finn. And he's always leading Samuel into things. He's happy. Everything is joyful. And what you don't know is what is going to happen. And so what you're going to hear is joy, laughter, people of a different stripe, and you're also going to hear some terror as time goes on. Anyway, Fred and Samuel have been having a great time together. Fred at this time is 11, Samuel is 10, and Fred is teaching Samuel all sorts of stuff. So finally, they've been fishing and all sorts of things, but Fred is wanting to make some slingshots. But the war is on. It's 1945, and they don't have any rubber to make the slingshots with because all of it is going to the military, you know. No one's here old enough to remember those days. But anyway, so it starts. It was a fine summer. Fred and me fished a lot, and every now and then Lonnie and LD come down. Those were friends of theirs. Everything would have been perfect except Fred and me didn't have slingshots. Something always come up that kept Dad from going to see his friend Ike. Lonnie and LD had their slingshots from the year before, and Fred was getting down in the dumps because we didn't have anything to shoot. Finally, one Sunday, Dad had to go see Ike about a heifer and promised to ask about an inner tube. What he brought home was a beauty. I told Fred that Dad was going to go see Ike the day before, and when I got to the barbed wire gap to tell him about the tube, he saw me, and we started running toward each other, me yelling, "I got it, I got it, whole inner tube, grade A shapes." "Hot dog, whoo," he yelled, and it was like light shot out over his face. "You got all the other stuff?" I asked. Fred started pulling pieces of rawhide and yellow bull durum twine out of every pocket. "Got it all set in the handles, and we'll cut some of them, some elm for them." "Where'd you get that much twine?" I asked. "Paul and Uncle Charlie was a saving hit for me. About 6 months now. That's a pretty good lot of smoking, 6 months. How come we got to use that? We got lots of white string at the house." Fred shook his head. "Honey, white string ain't no good. Always use bull durum twine, and it'll stay till the cows come home." He cocked his hands like he was holding a slingshot and said, "Bam! Got that big old frog right between the eyes." Then he jumped up in the air and flopped down flat on his back with his head to the side and tongue hanging out. I flopped down too, and we laughed like fools and rolled around on the grass. In a few minutes, we stopped and sat up. "Well," I said, waiting for him to make the next move. He didn't, though. He just kind of grinned. Then he jumped up. Well, there's a hole in the ground. Honey, let's get to work." And we struck out for an elm thicket. On the way to the thicket, we ran around a low rim of the volcano hill. It was too steep to plow and was used mostly as a sheep pasture. And like any sheep pasture, it was full of little paths about a foot wide. Sheep paths are all alike. Nothing grows on them, not even Bermuda, and it'll grow out of rock. This part of the trip was nice since the path was covered with fine dust, and we could drag our bare feet in it. Fred was feeling great and come on singing. "Out of the way, old Dan Tucker, it's too late for to get your supper. Out of the way, old Dan Tucker, it's too late for to get your supper." Now, old Dan Tucker was a nice old man, washed his face in the frying pan, combed his hair with a wagon wheel, and died with a toothache in his heel. When we got to the thicket, Fred Klein started checking trees for handles. He wouldn't use just any fork. It had to be a perfect Y, and that ain't easy to find. It took us forever to get just what he wanted, and I thought I'd go buggy. Then we had to bark 'em. Elm bark don't come off easy. You cut a little too deep and you're back hunting forks, so it took a couple more hours just to skin 'em and cut the grooves around the top. Once we had that done, we cut rubber strips about a half inch wide from the inner tube and tied them over the grooves in the handles with the bull durum twine. We made the loaders out of some soft rawhide, and boy, they were pretty. Fred loaded up a rock and took aim at the fence post. Bam! He hit it, leaving a dent in the split locust log. I didn't do so hot, but managed to hit the post the third time around. So I'll listen to your questions right now. Huh?
Okay. I want to ask about your writing and getting up so early in the morning, and how long did that take you to do that?
The book was written over a period of 40 years. And right, I did get up at 4:30 in the morning some and write. And I managed to write the boys' story. And this was, you know, when I finally finished it. And then when I retired, I took a look at it. And, you know, this was written by a young man. And I was now an old man. So I thought, you know, why not write what happens to Samuel after he leaves the sharecropping farm? And so I wrote that part. And then I fit the two together, you know, like tongue and groove. And that's how it came out. And that's the whole story of it. So it was produced over a long period of time. Yes, sir.
How much autobiography is there?
A lot. Yeah, a lot. The characters, you will find these characters in every Southern community. In 1945, you know, things have changed dramatically in the South since those times. But the area, the topography that I describe in Fayette County, Kentucky, is the way it was, with the exception of the Kentucky River, which has more than two bends, and it winds like a snake, you know, towards the eventual emptying. But I had reasons for making it just two bends. But the boys, the sharecropping experience, we sharecropped until I was 14, and then we bought our own farm in northern Kentucky. So I know the people, and as far as the academic part, I was in academic medicine. I wasn't in academic literature, but once you've been in academia, you know, academia is academia. It's going to be that way. You know, it's just what you read is what's there. Doesn't make any difference what department you're in.
Also, how is it that I should talk louder. How is it that your parents decided to go to Kentucky?
Well, my parents were both immigrants to this country from Lithuania. And mom came over when she was 2 years old with her family, dad when he was 16 in 1912. And basically he was looking for opportunity, and there was none if you were Jewish in Lithuania. And there was also violence, anti-Semitism. So once he got to this country, you know, he learned English, and he wound up in an agricultural school. And one thing led to another, and he wound up in Kentucky and as a farmer. And then he bought a farm in 1929, of course, lost it in 32, and went back to sharecropping. And it's the story of all people from those times and went through the Depression and that sort of thing. Yes, sir. That's an interesting question. I didn't hit any anti-Semitism just a tiny bit a couple of times among the sharecropping people in Kentucky. The only time I hit anti-Semitism was when I got to the big cities. Then I hit some. But not among the sharecropping people. They didn't know what to think about us. They didn't know anything about the religion. They knew Christ was a Jew. And I I guess they kind of worried that I might be a member of the family, so they they treated me pretty nice. Okay, I think I better go on, and we'll take some more questions at the end. Samuel has gone back to Kentucky, as I said, and he's been wandering this farm. He's depressed and being a good Kentuckian. He's laying there in this hotel room in Lexington getting drunk. You know? So anyway, he's thinking about his dead wife, you know, and he's just so lonesome. So he says, "Nora, I used to believe in ghosts. I wish you would show up. I'll speak hillbilly to you if you will. That's a promise, Nora." Her spoken name brought memories. We met my second year of graduate school at NYU. I was living on a stipend that kept me poverty-stricken, then a windfall. My parents, who had always struggled financially, were now doing well and had sent me a $100 birthday gift. To celebrate, I went to a bar in Greenwich Village. After the bartender poured my drink, I discovered I had forgotten to add the money to my wallet. I was a dollar short and trying to placate a screaming barkeep. Suddenly, an arm materialized from behind me, slammed the dollar on the bar, and a woman's voice said to the bartender, "There's your dollar, jerk. Now shut the hell up." That was my introduction to Nora Epstein. For the rest of the evening, we wandered Greenwich Village and talked. Nora was 22, a senior at NYU, about 5'5", with a pretty face, black hair, large dark eyes, and a breathtaking figure. She was also fun. The only joy I encountered in New York City. I hated New York. I considered it dirty, vulgar, loud, violent, overpriced, and inhospitable. Yet, Nora was a New Yorker, and she was joy. We'd been seeing each other for about a month when she offered to make us dinner. My kitchen was a disaster. The refrigerator leaked, and only one burner of the grungy gas stove worked. My cooking utensils were an iron skillet, two pots with loose handles, and a pasta strainer. In the silverware drawer were two knives, two forks, and one spoon. But I had four plates, four bowls, three regular glasses, and for some reason, a champagne glass. Into the stark culinary landscape came Nora, bearing groceries, steaks, potatoes, croissants, the makings for a salad, and the crowning touch, a bottle of red wine. I can still remember her reaction when she saw the kitchen. Oy vey! We feasted, laughing and talking across from one another, our meal teetering at times on the peeling vinyl top of my unstable card table. When we were together, cold, hard New York City warmed and softened. After dinner, we drank the rest of the wine as we danced to music from the radio. Somewhere during Stars Fell on Alabama, we kissed. Then we kissed some more. Then we slowly danced into the bedroom where we gently disrobed each other, slipped between the sheets, and made tender, passionate love. A half hour after we finished, we made love again. This time, even more passionate and with a bit more abandon. Then we talked and stroked each other. My God, her body was beautiful. Eventually, we fell asleep in each other's arms. A siren outside the hotel brought me back to the present. I got up, poured myself another shot of bourbon, then went back to bed. Soon I returned to my reverie. I thought about waking up that Sunday morning after a perfect night. I was in love and desperate to whisper to Nora. But I was terrified. We had known each other such a short time, and I wasn't sure how deep her feelings went for me. I wandered around the room. I worried that if I got serious too soon, I might lose her. How could she know how she felt in 1 month? But then, what did I know about Nora? We talked at length about literature, politics, Judaism, and a little about me. We hardly ever talked about Nora. When I told her I was born in Kentucky, she retorted that no Jew was ever born in Kentucky. I was either the second coming of Christ or lying. I stared at her sweet face. God, I loved her. While I was getting back into bed, she woke up. She smiled and stretched like a beautiful cat. Good morning, sweet prince. Good morning, I stammered. Want some breakfast? Or are you too tired? Nora laughed as I realized the double entendre. I could feel my face turn scarlet. She giggled. I am tired, but it's the sweetest tired I've ever been. Come here. I was happy to enter her arms, and even happier to hear our climactic moment. I love you, Samuel. I love you, Samuel's partly smothered by kissing lips and gasped for breath at my own voice, which shouted, I love you too. I love you, Nora. I was engaged. Sort of. Any other questions?
What made you interested in medicine?
Well, a guy's got to do something. No. No. Actually, I had... I always thought I'd wind up in farming or something like that, but my sister went out and was brought home a guy who was a physicist. And I had never met, I didn't even know what physics was, you know, at that time. I was about a junior in high school. Kentucky high schools weren't exactly strong at that time. He really impressed me, so I decided I would become a physicist. And so I went to the University of Kentucky. And, you know, it didn't take me too long to figure out that the math is pretty darn hard, you know. Maybe a little harder than I wanted. So, you know, I decided to become a physiologist because I took a course in biology. One thing led to another, and I wound up... in medicine, things just kind of happened to me. You know, I've felt so many times in my life that I'm not in control of anything. You know, somebody's up there doing this with a puppet. But that's how it happened. And the job in San Diego, the only medical job I had with the University of California. Went to San Diego on a visit, and decided to drop into the hospital and see what was going on. I met the guy who was head of nuclear medicine, and he was looking for somebody with exactly my qualifications, and so there I was. That's how it happened.
Do you have another book on the way?
Oh yeah, two. Yeah.
Why were you so afraid of being raw?
I'm sorry?
Why were you so afraid of being raw? Being somebody coming into your house. Your son raw.
Oh. Well, okay. I'm a Kentuckian. I had my first gun when I was 11 years old, a rifle, okay? My wife detests guns, and she won't let me keep one. And so, you know, the people, you know, every now and then will break into your home, you know, and I didn't have anything but a baseball bat to protect myself with. So, you know, I was concerned about it. I had an old Mossberg shotgun. I don't think the thing would ever work. You know, she hid the clip and everything else, you know, then took parts of it away. The bolt disappeared and everything, you know. So I'm defenseless, you know. 77 and defenseless. So anyway, I want to thank you very much for sharing your Monday with me. And I'll sign anything that you want, Justin's books and my books and whatever. Okay, thank you very much, folks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.